Good evening, everybody. I'm Joyce Francis, and I am an alcoholic. And before I forget my manners, I would like to say thank you to the committee for having me up here. There are some ups and downs about doing what I'm doing. One of the ups is you get to stay in a hotel or a motel. And Kay and committee just got a wonderful place for me down the street, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come and share what's happened to me in my life because of the program, before the program, and the hope for the future. I have a lot of all of it. I also want to say I enjoyed your theme. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't enjoy anything. I made sure I didn't. I didn't put myself in any positions that I could feel anything, good or bad. It seemed to me that whatever was happening in life was painful, and I learned at a very early age to just ignore, deny, become obsessed with some other behavior, and just not feel what was going on around me. And I didn't like what I was right from the get-go. I'd always felt strange. I always felt different. I felt less than, and I knew that I didn't feel like what my friends were appearing to feel like. And I just didn't belong anywhere. And where anywhere was Winnipeg, Canada. And I found out that I was Polish. And I certainly didn't want to be a Polak, I want to tell you. And you didn't want to be a Polak if you were from Winnipeg, Canada, because back then they didn't have any black people or Jews up there to discriminate against, no Mexicans. So they used Polaks and Ukrainians, and it just made me from the wrong side of the tracks. And, several years later, I was to, during inventory time, try and examine that. You know, was that one more thing that I created up here to feel sorry for myself and give me the excuse to drink? So I went back home and I ran some things by some people back there, and yes, indeed, they did discriminate. And we tried to hide what we were and where we were from. And it was kind of difficult. It created a lot of confusion in my early thoughts about myself. My grandmother and grandfather were right off the boat, right from the Ukraine, complete with the babushkas and the high-top boots, and they smelled funny. And they were cooking all kinds of funny things in my home. And my girlfriends, my closest friends, Edith and Ina and Maureen, they were white. They were English, Scotch, and Irish. And here I was, you know, very ashamed of these old people that acted and talked differently and made my house smell different from. And I was very ashamed of those people. And the conflict came because I also loved them. They were good to me and they were kind, but for some reason there was that thing that said to me, I must be like everybody else, I can't be like who and what I am. And that started a pattern very early of pretending, of fantasizing, of wanting to change things, of wanting to be someplace else other than where I was. And that was just to continue up until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, this rush inside of me that was to say constantly, you're no good, you're less than, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to change things. I got through school, they always said, she has the ability, if only she'd apply it. And I never knew what they meant by that. I graduated. I wanted to leave town. I wanted always and ever to leave Winnipeg because I knew whatever was happening was not going to be happening there in Winnipeg. I'd come on a trip to Los Angeles when I was about 16 by myself. I was always doing things that caused my mother and my stepfather anxiety. You know, I just didn't behave like Edith and Ina and Maureen. And I got on this bus and I traveled all the way down to Los Angeles. And I remember very little of the first 18 years of my life. But I have a lot of visions that have stuck with me through the years, and I can tell you what I was wearing, I can tell you what the weather was like, and I can tell you the feelings that I felt when those things occurred. And a few of the things that happened when I was in Los Angeles really made an imprint on my brain. I can remember standing on a street corner in one of our balmy summer nights near a Hawthorne shopping center, loaded down with a whole bunch of parcels, you know, with all the newfangled clothes they have down here. The styles reach Winnipeg about 10 years later. And I used to come home with plastic high heels and great big satin bow stuff, and I just loved coming down to Los Angeles. But this was on that first trip, and I was standing waiting for my aunt and uncle to come pick me up, and I looked across the street, and there was a bar there. We didn't have bars in Winnipeg at that time. The only place you could get liquor was at a government-controlled liquor commission. You had to go and stand in line just like you were going to the bank. And there was a neon outline of a cocktail glass with a swizzle stick and a couple of red circles in there, obviously the cherries, right? And three girls came walking out of that bar, and they were laughing and just having a great time, and their voices just came across the street to me, and I can remember thinking, that's for me. That's where it's at. That's where life is. So at age 16, the stage has already been set. I hadn't had a drinking problem up until that time, but somehow, some way, I knew I was going to come back to Los Angeles and live the life here, because this is where it was happening. This is where I'd be free, and nobody would be telling me what to do, and I wouldn't be getting in anybody's way, and I'd be happy. The feelings that I had inside of me would go away. I did get to Los Angeles via applying for employment with Trans World Airlines. They came to Winnipeg and put an ad in the paper for stewardesses. I'd always wanted to be a stewardess. I had a lot of fantasies growing up of being a stewardess, but I never told anybody anything about those fantasies because I just didn't tell anybody anything about myself, especially if it was something good. For some reason, I ended up with this feeling that nothing good was ever going to happen to me, and so I learned never to expect anything or ask for anything, and guess what? That's what I got, was nothing. So it was a very familiar feeling, you know, but I still had the fantasies. I went down and I applied for the job, and I didn't tell anybody I was going down there. I left home for work. I was a receptionist in a radio station at that time, not too long out of high school. And I called in sick to the radio station, and of course my mom thought I'd gone to work. I went down to the Royal Alec Hotel there, and they told me I was too skinny, that I would have to gain some weight if I was to be a stewardess. And that it's odd that I remember that too later on in inventory time, because up until then I thought that I was short and fat and I had buck teeth, and I did. These have been capped twice, and I had a face full of freckles, and I spent a lot of time tonight camouflaging the same. That mousy brown hair has changed color too, thanks to sparkling sherry from Clairol, however. Not quite the same color I started out with. But the point is, I still retained the thoughts that I was short and fat and dumpy. What really happened in reality was that I got very tall and slender and filled out in all the right places, but I never saw myself that way. I still remember being teased when I was smaller. You know, I was just totally out of touch with myself and who I was and how I appeared and anything as far as any personal feelings about myself. I had none. But anyway, I'd gained those 4 pounds or 6 pounds, whatever they wanted, and when they came back to Winnipeg, they hired me, and I still hadn't told anybody I went down and applied, because I learned very early on that I don't tell anybody anything about myself. That way, if I fail, I don't have to go back and tell anybody why I failed. So if I keep all these secrets and I don't divulge anything, then I'm safe, right? Then it'll be okay, because no way would I ever put myself in a position not to win, not to come in first. I never learned how to swim because I couldn't jump off that diving board and come up looking like Esther Williams. Those of you who remember Esther Williams, she was a great swimmer. Never occurred to me to go to the shallow end of the pool and learn how to float with the rest of those dummies, you know. They would have known I didn't know how to swim, and that wasn't acceptable to me. So I just never learned how to swim. I never went in the baseball team because I couldn't assure myself of getting a home run, you know, second or third base. Or even striking out would have just been devastating to me. It was just not acceptable. And so I denied myself an awful lot growing up. I just made a world whereby I didn't have contact with anything that was going to be a challenge. And nothing really happened to me the whole time I was growing up. I think all of it happened in sobriety and is happening and continues to happen. I was hired and I went to Kansas City to train to be the stewardess, and it was at that time that I really feel that, well, emotionally, I wasn't ready to leave home. Intellectually, physically, fine, but emotionally there was no way that I knew how to handle myself out on the streets, so to speak. I didn't know that there was an answer in alcohol for me at that time. Up until then, the only experience I'd had with it was underneath the table. My Baba and Gigi always had a bottle of wine. You always drank before meals. And I can remember sitting underneath the table once, and they used to give me sips of that wine, and I can remember when it would hit and go up to my ears, and I would glow, and everything would be okay. I can still feel those feelings, but it wasn't something that I had to do on a daily basis. It became an obsession after I left home, after I left the nest, so to speak. And another one of the visions I have is when they gave us the talk, all us new girls in the class, they said, you don't leave the Brookside Hotel for the duration of the training. You don't date, and there's no alcohol allowed. Well, they put me in a room in this hotel with two models and Miss Denver, right? And no way could my inadequacy and my self-esteem handle this, and I was just sure that any moment now they were going to discover who they had tentatively hired, and they were going to send me back to Winnipeg. I had taken a chance, you know, this exterior that I had created that looked so comfortable, that looked like it was having a good time, that looked like it was part of the world, was nothing of what was going on inside. But I was faking it. And I had a lot of those feelings I know today were guilt, and there were fear, and there were inadequacies, and just no self-esteem. But on the outside, you never would have known it. I can remember walking over to the window and looking out and saying to the girls, "My gosh, look at those guys over there in that next motel. Let's go over and see if they'll buy us a drink." Somehow, some way, I knew that there was an answer there. Well, both, two obsessions. You know, the man was going to make me feel good, and the drink was going to make me feel good. Up until then, I'd had boyfriends through school, and that was probably my first obsession, that first addictive behavior that I had to make Joyce feel like somebody. I had to have some fellow to go out with, some young man to validate my being, and that obsession was to continue. In fact, I'm not so sure it's over yet, come to think of it. But it was very important that I have that young man, because then I felt that you all would say, well, she's got to be worth being with, or he wouldn't be with her, right? And I hadn't the wherewithal to go anywhere by myself. I felt strange and unrelated to the world if I walked anywhere where there was any social gathering, even on a bus trip to downtown. You know, I just couldn't handle anything by myself. The fear just took over. I always felt odd and awkward. So to have that young man to hang on to, and subsequently the man, any man, you know, if it was warm and it was breathing, it was my man, you know. There was no basis for any of these relationships. You know, you were there for a purpose. I needed you. Don't you understand that? And I had a very mixed up conception of love at that time. I thought I was in love. I thought sex was love. I didn't know that there was a difference. Certainly when I was involved with a man and he was holding me in his arms, he was making me feel good. He was telling me all kinds of nice things like, "You're beautiful, you're wonderful." And that was what I thought was love. And that was really the only time that I felt loved. And yes, it did become an obsession, because it made me feel okay to stand on this earth. The drinking was an obsession, too, that hit the minute I started. I had to have alcohol. Alcohol, for me, was like medicine. It wasn't a social lubricant. I needed it for a purpose, because when I took that first drink of alcohol, It made me feel okay. It never made me feel gorgeous. It never made me the life of the party. I never wanted that. I just wanted to function, and I wanted that feeling to go away inside, and that's what it did for me. I had to have alcohol to do just about anything, and I went down fast. I drank consistently on a daily basis for probably 8-9 years, and it never got better. It always got worse. I flew for Transworld Airlines for about 3 years. Now we're talking flying Constellations. I did well. I worked hard. I made sure that I did the very best of anybody on that airplane, because already I was doing things that I couldn't explain to myself. I was doing things behind alcohol that I didn't want to do. I thought I was doing them because I was bad. Certainly, I had always felt bad. Besides being Polish, I was also Catholic, right? And that created an awful lot of problem for me. That Catholic Church just filled me with awful lot of fear. I didn't like going to confession. That just terrorized me. They always wanted me to go. My grandparents and my mother and my stepfather were always making me go to confession, and I just hated it. I didn't know what they wanted from me. I didn't identify with anything. All as I knew is that I had to get in a little booth that had a curtain in front of it, and I knew there was somebody in the center waiting for me to tell all the bad things that I had done. And it was just a terrifying experience for me. I got no comfort from any of the church teachings, and it was my conception. It was my feelings about what was happening. I have a sister 3 years older, and she didn't come out of this childhood with any of these things that I have. So it wasn't anything that anybody did to me. It was the way I related. But I can remember being on my knees in that dark place, and it was always at the bottom of this Ukrainian church that just smelled awful, and all those little Ukrainian ladies and men were just lined up, could hardly wait to get in there, and they always had these beads wrapped around their hands, and they were always clacking them. I could never figure out why they were saying them over and over again. Didn't they get it the first time, you know? And I made up a list of sins that I told the priest every time I went in there, and I'd be sitting there waiting, and I'm not soft-spoken today, but when I get full of fear, I can't whisper, you know, and that's what you're supposed to do in there. And I'd sit there and I'd wait, and all of a sudden he'd go whap, and that little door would shoot open, you know, and I'd go, you're on, you know, do it, and get out of here. And it was terrible. It was an awful experience for me. Towards the end of my drinking, I got to move along here and get caught up in that childhood. There's a reason for that, but towards the end of my drinking, or I used to try and get back to the Catholic religion. There was always that feeling inside of me that somewhere there was help for me, and I think that's probably the only reason that I'm alive today. I always knew that I was crazy. I accepted that without a shadow of a doubt. I just didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I thought that because I was crazy, I drank. It never occurred to me that because I drank, I did crazy things. When I took that first drink of alcohol, I couldn't guarantee my behavior to myself or to anybody else. But for a long time, I had the feeling that alcohol was my friend, because certainly when I drank, it took the edge off of things. I didn't feel as fearful. Things weren't as sharp. I didn't feel as much. I think, you know, I have a twofold disease. I believe that. And I need to say here that anything that I say is strictly my opinion and not necessarily the views of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I really believe that I have a twofold disease. I had the ism long before I took the first drink and the stage was set, and then I was off and running. And I think that's probably why I stick so close to Alcoholics Anonymous now. I don't drink anymore, but I continue to think. And that continues to give me food for growth in the program. And so here we go, back to getting into the program and thinking I was crazy. And I wanted life to be over. I felt that everything that had to be done, I had already done. I had tried being this stewardess, and in my eyes, I failed. I didn't fail. I chose a husband for myself. He was 14 years older than me, and I was 19 at the time, so I was looking for that daddy that I never had when I grew up. My real dad died when I was 3 years old, And for some reason or another, motives probably thought they were good, but reasoning was not good. Everybody pretended like my real dad didn't exist. They got rid of all his pictures. They never talked about him. And my mother remarried a white man, by the way, an Irishman, shortly after he died. And later on, I had that feeling that I just didn't belong, that there was something odd and weird. Well, there were a lot of things weird about me. One was I had three grandmas and three grandpas, and everybody else only had two. See, I told you, you know, and I thought, well, again, they must have adopted me. And then I looked on the back of a baby picture in my mother's bedroom, and there it was. I was Joyce Marilyn Melnick. I wasn't Joyce Marilyn Ahern like they'd been telling me. And so there was a lot of confusion. Somehow I took that, and I just knew I had killed my father. I was somehow responsible for his death, and I used to do weird things like go to the graveyards and try and find him. I thought if I can get close to him, he'd reveal himself for me and tell me something about me and him, because I knew I must be like him. I wasn't like anybody else in the family or the world as far as that went. I was very, very isolated. When I called Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what I was going to find here. I just felt that my life was over. I had tried all kinds of therapies. I was continually joining groups, going to psychiatrists, and they all told me, yeah, you really need help, but we just don't know what's wrong with you. Of course, I wasn't telling them how much I was drinking, because at that point, you know, preservation comes in. I was afraid that if I told them how much I was drinking, they're liable to say, don't drink. And there's no way that I could go without drinking, because that was the only time I got any peace, was when I was just about ready to pass out. And pass out I did on a daily basis. Every night I drank to do with me what I needed it to do, which was pass me out. I never went to sleep. I realized that, again, during inventory time. My ex-husband used to say strange things like, I never know who's going to greet me when I open the door at night. You know, I didn't know who was going to greet him either. I never knew what personality would take, and it all depended a lot of times on what I was drinking. Wine made me maudlin, bourbon made me angry, beer just made me stupid, you know, so I never knew who was going to emerge. Now, all this time, I'm pretending I'm normal, right? I had a set of twins. Very shortly after we were married, and I just finished telling you a lie, we didn't get married right away. We didn't get married till a year and a half after the twins were born, but we pretended like we were married. One of the things that, boy, I'll tell you, when I look back and some of the things that I got myself into, we were in Tucumcari, New Mexico, going to get our marriage certificate and blood tests and everything, and he chose that moment to tell me that his divorce wasn't final. And I said, well, I don't think we should get married then, right? And he said, no, probably not. By this time, I was pregnant. So we just kind of faked it. It seemed like my whole life I've been faking and pretending, I perpetuated it. Every situation I got myself into, there was something to hide. Something wasn't right. There was just one more secret to keep, one more sin to commit that God could put in my side of the book. And there was an awful lot of denial during that time. The only time I could comfortably forget these things that were happening to me was when I was drinking. And yes, I did have to drink. I was by this time drinking beer and wine. I started out drinking hard liquor, but it made me drunk too fast. So I taught myself to drink beer and wine because I could coast longer on that, and I could function longer during the day than I could with drinking hard liquor. If I'm getting scattered, I'm having a hard time separating here. Should move along to when I get to the program, right? I think so. I called Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 26 years old. I had three sons by this time. Those twins were very premature. Mike and Paul were born at 2 pounds and 7 ounces and 2 pounds and 15 ounces, and Michael has cerebral palsy. Now, when that came to light, I just knew that that was the cross that that Catholic God had given me to bear, and I knew that he was the way he was because of what I did. And I accepted all that guilt. I had to make myself feel guilty enough to justify my drinking. And it worked. I didn't need to justify Michael being the way he is because of my 3 sons. He is probably the most mature, stable one of them all. He is a paraplegic, and they told me that he would never walk. He'd be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, and that is not so. He's ambulatory. He has less than 50% of his hearing, but he's got all of his brain, and he's just a wonderful, functioning human being, and I'm very proud and grateful for him today. But for a long time, I used him for an excuse to drink. He had a lot of major surgeries on his body, trying to bone graft from hips into legs to give him some movement. And we spent many years going to Rancho Los Amigos Hospital, Children's Hospital, hearing clinics, and it was just a nightmare, and it was a constant daily reminder of guilt for me that he was having to go through what he did because of me. And I tortured myself with that. And because of that torture, I had to drink even more and more because that was the only time I had any comfort. Another one of my visions I hope I never forget was one of Michael's last surgeries was done in Long Beach. And it was very late at night, and it was the day of the surgery, and he was coming out of the anesthetic at night, and it was late. I had already checked the street to see where the closest bar was because, you see, I had to do that. I had to check my supply. If I couldn't take it in with me, I had to know where I could get it when I needed it. And it was getting later and later, and Michael was getting restless, and I had to go to that bar. And I can remember walking down that very quiet hallway, hearing my own footsteps and hearing Michael in the background calling for me, you know, "Mama, Mama, where are you? I need you." And you know something, I couldn't turn around and go back to him. I had to go and do what I had to do, and that was to feed my disease. I hope I never forget that one. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what you people had for me here. I just knew that this was just one other place that I was going to have to try, because I did indeed try and go to everything I thought could bring me some peace. Nothing worked. I called the club in Manhattan Beach, and they sent over 3 ladies on a Sunday morning. And that was when the magic happened for me. It was a feeling that comes into being. It's just there where there are any people from Alcoholics Anonymous, a meeting, after the meeting, it doesn't matter where. That magic is continually there for me, and it happened that day. It's nothing tangible. It is truly the spirit. And I'm so grateful that the program is set up the way that it is, because you didn't ask anything else of me except to show up. If you'd have asked anything, sign anything, be anything, do anything, there was no way that I could have followed through for you, because I couldn't follow through for anything for myself. There was just nothing left inside. I had just denied everything and given everything away and used it all up as far as I was concerned, and I felt totally worthless. And these 3 ladies came, and they started and laughing. I remember their laughing. I love to laugh today. I can laugh at nothing, and I do laugh at nothing, because to me that's medicine. We started sharing, and they were so open with me, and they were telling me things about themselves, and I started telling them things about me that I thought I would never, ever tell another human being. Things like, I remember saying, "But you don't really know me." And they said, "Yes, we do." And then I said, "Do you know something? I've got a big bottle of wine underneath that sink." And they left another bottle of wine hidden in the garage. And then I siphon from that bottle into that bottle how much I think my husband would think I should have drunk the night before. You know, it was such hard work. I used to work at staying drunk and keeping my supply and not passing out too soon. And all the time, never ever acknowledging the fact that I had a problem with alcohol. It was awful hard work, and it was lonely work. Ultimately, I didn't have any friends. I just couldn't follow through with anything. I couldn't do the things that they were doing. They were going to classes, and I hated that Barbara across the street. Just hated her. She was short. She was tiny. Every hair was in place, and I used to see her sending her kids off to school in the morning. Those two little girls looked like little princesses, you know, and there they were, like 7:30, 8 o'clock, and she was sending them off to school, and she was waving to them, and I think, oh, I just can't stand you, Barbara. What made it even worse, she liked me. That I couldn't accept, because anybody that liked me had to mean that there was something wrong with you if you liked me. You know, I wouldn't like me if I were you. And it was just, I had to isolate, and isolate I did. I gave personalities to inanimate objects like my vacuum cleaner. You know, we had a real relationship, not a very good one, but we had a relationship nonetheless. I used to talk to that thing. I was a compulsive housekeeper too, by the way. You know, I had to do something besides everything else I was doing that showed a little bit of progress here. And I used to talk to that thing, and I can remember saying, "Now, please don't get my shins today. I promise I won't whip you around the corner as long as you don't get up on my shins." And I was serious about this stuff. You know, I used to hide the drinks. I used to put them in the cupboard, and I was alone in the house. There was nobody there. I'd put a do not disturb sign on the door and close the drapes, take the phone off the hook, and drink. And then be very lonely because nobody loved me. Well, you know, you couldn't get to me. There was just nothing here. It was just a veneer. It was just a show. Now, I took care of my three sons. They were fed and they were clothed and they looked cute all the time and the house was clean. But as far as anything else went, there was nothing. When I got to the program, I was grateful for a bit, thinking to myself, well, thank God the boys didn't get to see too much of my drinking. They were too young, that I didn't do them any damage, right? Wrong, you know. They didn't have a mother when they really needed a mother, but it was a long time in coming. I support all three of them today the very best way that I can to try and make my amends, and it works. But there was a lot of damage done because I wasn't there for them emotionally. I didn't have any idea what a mother was, what a mother was supposed to provide. I thought you just fed the kid, kept the kid's clothes clean, and that was it. I was very, very self-obsessed. I lived in my own world between my ears, and that was not a very good place to be. I started going to meetings because, again, that magic happened. When I walk in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's there, and it's there for me today. I'm the type of person that very willingly has given power, my power over my life, to any person, place, or thing that would take it. You know, please take the responsibility for me because I don't know what to do and I don't know how to live. When I got here, it was more like an animal. Just satisfy my instincts. Don't ask any more of me because I don't have anything to give, and I'm sure what I've got you don't want anyway. And again, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous because you allowed me to come and stay here and just suck you people dry. And that worked for a long time. I knew I was an alcoholic right away because I identified with your sharing. I identified with what you were saying and what you were feeling, and I really felt like I belonged. But I couldn't stay sober. I had no higher power for an awful long time. It was about 3 years. I was in and out, in and out. I did get the strength to get my three children, and we left the marriage. I came out to Azusa, and I went to live with an aunt, and I was just crazier than a hoot owl. Please believe me. I was just totally out of reality, and it's a good thing I was as crazy as I was, because if I had an ounce of brains, I would have realized, you know, there's no way you're going to make it, woman. Not with three kids. You have no training. You have no money. I didn't have enough self-esteem to follow through with the divorce. He forged my name on the house, and he got the house. He didn't give me anything, you know, and that was okay. I didn't feel like I deserved anything, don't you understand? So it didn't make any difference to me whether I came away of that marriage with anything or not, but I knew I needed my children. And I started going to meetings, and I kept going to meetings and kept going to meetings. I kept also connecting with yet one more higher power in a pair of pants, however. And that has always failed, and it always will fail. But so hard did I try to find my God in a pair of Levi's. And that's never going to work, you know. But I tried. But I also never once gave up the desire to stop drinking. That was the only thing that I could do for myself, and that probably is the one thing that saved my life. I couldn't share at meetings what you are seeing here tonight. Please believe me, is just a total miracle. I couldn't even open my mouth and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. I thought you'd throw me out one more time. I just knew I wasn't good enough to be anywhere. And so I just made myself as unobtrusive as I could, and I didn't share. I stuck with the man, and you can imagine what man I would latch on to. One more sicko from the 502 Club in Covina. You know, they were there waiting for me, and I was there looking for them. And when something emotional would happen, when that pain would start, the only answer I had for a long time was to drink. And please believe me, if there is anybody in here contemplating going back out again, I can testify to the fact that it gets worse, never better. I would stay sober 2-3 months. I would stay sober once 9 months. And I went out and I got drunk, and it was just like yesterday from that daily drinking. It really does get worse. That last time that I drank, I one more time drank over a man. I thought I wanted to do something with him that I couldn't do sober. And so I drank, and we did it. And one more time tried that relationship that was destined to fail. And I remember going into a bar in Covina, and I had been to AA for about a year and a half by this time, and here's all that I learned. I can remember, again, one of my visions, going down the end of that bar and calling the bartender over and saying to him, "Look, I'm an alcoholic. Don't serve me any more than 3 drinks. 2 hours later, I looked up, and he was drunker than I was. I tried to find my way home that day, and I didn't live that far, but I was going in and out of a blackout, in and out of a blackout, and it was so hot in Azusa. God, it was hot. But at that point, I still wore girdles, right? And I can remember going down Arrow Highway, heading towards where I thought I lived, and you have to understand, this is a little girl running around in a woman's body. So what does a little girl do when she gets in trouble? She calls a policeman, right? So there I am in the fast lane at Arrow Highway near Hollenbeck, and I knew I couldn't drive anymore because I couldn't keep myself focused on where I was going, which all I wanted to do is get home. So I stopped the car in the fast lane and leaned on the horn. And like magic, there was a policeman. And he said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" And I said, "I'm drunk and I can't find my way home." He said, "Lady, follow me." So he got in his car and I got in mine, and we went about a block and a half, and he flagged me over, and we parked there right in front of Ollie's. I'll never forget this. See, this weirdest thing stick in my head. And I parked behind him, and he got out and he said, "Lady, you really are drunk." He said, "Park your car and get in mine." And so I did, but I could never figure this one out. Somewhere between stopping in the fast lane and leaning on the horn and me getting in his car, I somehow got my girdle off, because I got out of my car dragging my girdle with my nylons behind, right? And the only thing I can think of is I must have got out the car, because you don't take a girdle off while sitting. Taking the girdle off and got back in the car. You know, thank God that's blacked out, because I do not remember. Anyway, he took me home. We found where we lived, and he took me home and he put me to bed. Would you believe that? He didn't take me to jail. And then the next day, I couldn't find my car. You know, I knew I could see the Ollie's, and I knew Arrow Highway, and I had to go down to the club and find somebody to come back and help me find my car. And so it doesn't get better. It got worse. And that drunk devastated me, because by this time I thought, there's no way I'm ever going to stay sober. But that wasn't true. I started doing some of the things that you people told me that I needed to do. But somehow I didn't think you meant me when you said, call somebody before you take that first drink. Call somebody if you need some direction. Go to a whole lot of meetings. You know, don't run in at the last minute and out at the first minute. Get to know people. Get phone numbers. For some reason, I didn't think you meant me, but you did mean me. But nothing really happened until I started doing those things, until I started exposing myself at the podium, until I started making that phone call. Then the magic, more magic happened. I was given the gift of a woman friend. I'd never had a woman friend. I thought I hated women. I thought women hated me. I just was very fearful of women. I didn't identify. I also knew that if you knew anything about me, you wouldn't like me. So why even get to know you anyway? Why put myself in the position? Why not stick with the guy? At least he makes me feel okay. Nomi was given to me as a friend, and we started a relationship, and I look back on that, and it's wonderful because I found out that I could talk to a woman. We talked and we talked and we talked. We talked day and night and just on and on and on. It was no problem with me at that time to change my patterns, to get rid of the men in my life, to get connected with the woman. That's where my answers are today. I didn't think I identified with women. I thought there was nothing there that was of value to me, and certainly you wouldn't want anything from me because you'd find out who and what I was, and I was dirt as far as I was concerned. I started going to meetings. I took the chance and identified at a meeting. I said my name was Joyce and I was an alcoholic, and that started my crying period in AA, and I sniveled and sniveled and sniveled and sniveled, and nobody threw me out. I didn't have to get up here and be perfect. I didn't have to get up here and edit and monitor everything I was to say. That's just the way I felt, that total inadequacy, that feeling of just being so unique and so different. That's what almost killed me. I remember the first time that I shared at a meeting, I read the steps, and it was at the Glendora meeting, and three times during the meeting, a train went by on the right outside the window. I always remember the trains that went by. And I sat down after I read the steps. I didn't read the steps because funny things happened to me when I would get up to the podium. My eyes would unfocus. Total terror would take over, and my voice would go way down here. And I would just shake like, have you ever seen that was me. I sat down and I said to Norma, did you hear me? Did you hear me? I did it. I did it. She said, I didn't hear a thing you said. The podium didn't have a front on it, right? It was just a shell. She said, I was so busy watching your knees. I have never seen knees do what yours did up there. I went home that night. I pitched myself all night long. It was just wonderful. What a wonderful thing to get up here. Finally, after being in and out, in and out. That was when I finally felt a part of just a little bit. More magic happened when I finally dared take that fourth step. I could get through 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3. I could never, ever do that fourth step. I didn't know what y'all wanted to hear. There was nothing, don't you understand? I didn't know who and what I was, so I didn't know what to put down. I asked Harvey A. from our area, is there a sample inventory that I could read so I know what to put in mine, you know? And he laughed at me. But I was sincere. I really and truly was sincere because I knew that if I was ever going to live and survive, it was going to be within the confines of the program. I wanted it to be that way. I just didn't know how to do it. Everything I'd done up until then had been wrong anyway. And I was so fearful I was going to take that fourth step. And at that time, several years ago, everybody was saying, why don't you take that fourth step? You never have to take another drink as long as you live. And I think, oh yeah? Watch it. I'll take that fourth step and I'll get drunk. So when I didn't take that fourth step, I still had a chance, right? Wrong. I got into so much pain so many times, and one more time it was always over another involvement. This one happened to be with Larry Francis. Now, he was something new and different in my life. I'd had a lot of meetings up until now. Remember, I got Nomi in my life, and I'm starting to go to meetings with good motives, not to check out the guys or check out the next arm to hang on to. I started being invited on 12-step calls, and I want to tell you, there's nothing like that feeling to go on a 12-step call and to take a new person to a meeting and watch the magic happen. And those things that started happening to me. So along comes this Larry Francis, right? I was sober 6 months this last time. And he came into the Covina Club, and he was yellow, and he was bald, and his teeth needed attention, and he had kind of like a hunchback, and he just kind of, you know, and he just really was just weird. But he was my man, right? And he had big hands. And I liked the way he looked at me, and He looked needy. Does that tell you anything else about me? He looked like he needed me. Now, that's a whole nother pitch. But I think that was the connection. And they asked me to take him to a meeting, and I had Nomi with me, so we took this guy to a meeting. And very cautiously we started, because by this time I knew I could survive without a man in my life. I had no idea I could do that. I had no idea at one point I could survive without alcohol. Now you're asking me to give up men. You know, I just traded addiction for addiction. But it was possible because Nomi fulfilled in me the things that I'd always been looking for in men and in bars. You know, just some feeling of being a human, of being validated. So we started going to the same meetings together and one thing and another, and we ultimately started a relationship. And I remember feeling different about this man. I loved him first with feelings that I had never felt in my life for anybody. Now, we're talking like 10, 11, 12-year-old here, and I'm this 30-something woman feeling giddy. Every time he looks at me, I laugh. He brushes my arm. I think I'm going to faint. He holds me, and something happens from here to here that I think I just can't stand it. It kind of like hurts, but it hurts so good, I can't stand it some more. You know, it was just unreal. All I did was giggle. Birds started singing. All of a sudden, music on radio, you know, all those words started making sense. And I couldn't stand it. It was like I was floating. Right now I've got this mother with three kids and I'm working and I just, and all these things are happening to me, and I was just beside myself with this. You believe I became addicted to that man? He made me feel good. I had to have him in my life. I had to know where he was, what he was doing. I wanted to take that man, put him in a bottle, stop it up, and when I thought he needed a breath, boom, mine. You know. I had to keep him alive, don't you understand? We went to a lot of meetings because no way was I going to let him go to a meeting by himself. I had to check out who was looking at him, right? Or who he was looking at. So we went to an awful lot of meetings those first couple of years. We got sponsors. We started this relationship within the confines of the program, and that's the way it ended up. And I know you're not supposed to get involved in your first year, and I know, and I feel very strong about that today, but that's not the way I was able to do it. So I have got a lot of experience to share with new women. We worked hard, Larry and I. I was coming off of state aid. We had Michael had his last surgery, and Larry was just incapable of working. He was hearing music coming out of the furnace from his house. I mean, that's where he was. And he was a musician and an iron worker, and he couldn't figure out which one he wanted to be. So I was on state aid, and we had one of those relationships. You know, he had a sham apartment down the street. It wasn't cool to live together back then. And he spent an awful lot of time at my place, but always within the confines of the program. And I was so obsessed with this man, I want to tell you, it was just crazy. I learned a lot of emotions on him. I'd never felt jealousy, because I'd never felt for anybody the way I felt for him. I'd never felt possessiveness, because there was never any basis for any of my other men in my life, you know. And I had introduced him to Nomi, this friend that I'd told everything to, right? She was a musician, and so was Larry, and he'd built a Heathkit organ from a kit, and she didn't drive, so I arranged a ride. I'm a great arranger, too. Mine, a controller, that's another pitch. And anyway, I arranged for Larry to give Nomi a ride home, and he's late getting back to my apartment, right? And there was a stop sign. I was living in the Vadio in Azusa then, not in the front house, in the third house back in the driveway there. But I could hear the cars that stopped at the stop sign, and they'd crunch over the rocks, and I'd know if they were coming to my house or not. And I would sit there and wait for the cars to stop at the stop sign and try and urge the cars into my driveway. It had to be him. It had to be him. It had to be him. No, the sucker would go down the street, and I'd rearrange myself and wait for the next car to come and just urge that one. And, well, finally he got there, and he came in, and I'm being cool because I don't know what these feelings are. All I know is I'm a mess, I'm a basket case, and I'm doing all kinds of weird things inside, but I don't identify any of these emotions. And he walked in and said, hi. I said, well, hi, how are you? Where have you been? Well, I took Nomi to my apartment to show her my organ. Oh, yeah? And what organ did you show her? Right? And with that, and here's what I remember. I remember feeling blood draining out of my face, tears were spurting out of my eyes. I wasn't crying, but they were just... And my armpits prickle. When I get real upset or nervous or upset, my armpits prickle. And I started shaking, and again, that lip is going like this. So I got up, and I went in the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I thought, there it was, the white face. The freckles are just like neon lights. These tears are just shooting out of those eyes. These armpits are pricking me crazy. And I thought, I'm jealous. I've got it, you know. I identified that feeling for the first time. Do you know what that meant to me? It made me feel so human. That's a sum total of everything that's happened to me in AA. I was nothing when I got here. Without you people, I would have been nothing. There was nothing going on inside. And that's just the beginning, and I don't even know what time it is. And I probably have a few minutes left. So take it from there, folks. That's the way I learned about jealousy. That's the way, and you know I had to go to Al-Anon. I was probably one of the first closet Al-Anon members that you had back then because it wasn't kosher to wear two hats. I had to go. I couldn't stand not going because I was really running amok. Larry said several years later that it was a good thing that he was as crazy as he was because he didn't even realize how crazy I was. And he had to be crazy to pick a woman with three small boys, one handicap to begin with, he used to say. But that wasn't true. So here we are, coming off of state aid, and Larry's finally getting straightened around, decided he's going to be an iron worker. He did glass and glazing. And I was working for a wind oil company, and I'd gone back to Citrus College and learned how to type and take shorthand and got a little bit of training. And it was wonderful, you know, except I had to be Ms. This and Ms. AA. And at 5 years sober, I went friggin' nuts. You know, I was taking care of these three kids. We got married. We had an AA wedding, which was just another experience I wish I could tell you about, but it really and truly was. Again, people came to my wedding, and I was just shocked. I had no idea I had friends in the program. I had still, you know, my self-esteem, if I'm having trouble today, you can bet your boots, somewhere along the line, it's my self-esteem that's run amok here, that this thing that I have that I don't deserve anything. That comes from way back, and it may always be there, and that gives me something to work on. But I can always remember feeling, my God, there's people here, just when I was going up the aisle. And I got so involved, and it was like a dream. And I can remember when Nomi was trying to give me the flowers, or I was supposed to give her the flowers. It was just very dream-like, this whole experience. It was just wonderful. Anyway, we became very successful very fast. We started a business. I bought a little house in Azusa there. I worked hard, he worked hard, and the harder we worked, the more we got, the more we gave away. That's a secret, by the way. The more you get in AA in any area, the more you give, the more you get back in any area. I just gave myself goosebumps. So here we go, you know, always within the confines of program. We start this business and it's just rolling around making money like you can't believe, and he's spending money on me, and I can't stand being spent money on. Did that make sense? I can't stand to have things bought for me because I don't feel deserving. He's buying me all kinds of things. He loved to show his success in me, I found out years later. But I've got this old mentality, you know, I don't deserve anything. You don't buy anything, for God's sake. You know, I was raised, you don't tell anybody anything about yourself, especially about your finances or what you paid for anything or what you got in the bank or, you know, nothing like that. And here was just all these wonderful things happening, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand the gifts that were being given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to look at my program one more time. I went into a deep depression. It was awful. It was almost like to kill me, and found out that I was not allowing my God to work in my life to give me what I was working so hard to get. And that was one of our biggest hurdles. We got very successful in the business, and we were doing the Bonaventure Hotel. Those of you who know that hotel of five round towers in Los Angeles, we were putting the glass and the metal around that hotel, and Larry got sick. We'd been married, this was his 10th year of sobriety at this time. His birthday was in January, mine's in July. I have 6 months more. And he had had what we thought was the flu a couple of times that year. And he was a big bull of a man. He just never complained, never went to doctors. Now, one night I was laying on his chest, and I heard a funny rattle in there. I took him into the hospital, and 3 weeks later, he was dead of leukemia. And Minka, child born to Larry and I, wasn't quite 5 years old at that time, and she was another miracle that happened in sobriety. I really questioned God's judgment when I turned up pregnant. I thought, there's no way, but, you know, are you sure? I'm too old to have a baby. I've got real sons that are, you know, a lot older. And when I told Larry, he turned yellow and said, I think I'll go get a pack of cigarettes. And I thought I'd seen the last of him. And but along came Minka, you know, just the joy of our life, and she remains that today. But anyway, after Larry died, I thought, there's no way that I can handle this. You know, I did have a higher power working in my life, but yes, I was also dependent on him. I got an awful lot of strength from him. I was connected with him. I had no idea that there could be life after Larry. When he was in the hospital and needed me to be with him at this point, and we didn't know he was going to die, and I don't know if he knew he was going to die, my AA people did for me everything that I couldn't do for myself, and you people are my people, and you would have done the same if I were from your area. You took care of everything for me that needed to be done. You took care of my baby. You took care of my three sons. You took care of my business. You took care of my home to free me to be with my husband when he needed me the most. And that gratitude in itself keeps me coming back for my own reasons. I thought after he died, you know, this just shouldn't be. My sponsor said to me, now the fruits of your 10 years will show. And I said, Kathy, there's just no way, you know, I can't do this. It never once occurred to me that a drink of alcohol would take away the pain. And if indeed I was working my program the way that I was talking my program, and I had turned my will and my life over to the care of God, then I had to accept that fact. It didn't say that I had to like it, and I didn't like it. But I knew that I could survive on a day-to-day basis. I didn't have to take a drink. I was very angry for an awful long time, but I had all kinds of people to go to, people that would share their experience, strength, and hope with me. And one day at a time, it was possible for me. When I look back on our relationship, and I try to make myself feel guilty, because that's one of my old tricks, you know, somehow, some way, if I'd have fed him better, if I'd have taken better care of him, he wouldn't have died. That's not true. When I looked back on our relationship, I was the best of everything that I had ever been my whole life. I was the best mother, the best wife, and he was the only man in my life for 10 years, and I've shared a bit about my past. The cream on that whole thing is that I wasn't even trying to be that. That's the gift that this program has given me. It made me something that I'd always wanted to be. The last 10 years, I kept the glass business. It's a small glass business, and it's also a union glass business, and I keep trying to close the glass business, and my life just keeps rolling on, and there's changes in it. I have a very, very busy schedule today. My life is wrapped around Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the most important thing in my life. Daughter Minka, I need to tell you this because it's probably the biggest thing that's happening today, is going to be 19 next month, and she's going to move out. She's going to move near college. She turned out to be probably one of the best things that's happened in my whole life. She's a very mature, centered, focused, intelligent, gorgeous, becoming a lawyer. Yesterday she went to interview at the Glazers Union. They've decided to give scholarships. She went down to interview for a $2,000 scholarship. She has a good chance of getting it. And she called me right after the interview, and she said, oh, Ma, it was real good. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, they wanted to know this, they wanted to know that. And then the woman said, well, your mother must be real proud of you. And she said, yeah. And she said, and I told her, my mom is my very best friend in the whole wide world. And my heart stopped. And for that, I'm grateful. There are new people here tonight, I know. You're probably looking for the things that I've always been looking for love and for life. Thank you for mine, and keep coming back for yours.